The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com.
A Timekeeper's Duty by Tamara Kelvin. Flimsy sheets of homework with a mixture of the most vilest combinations of letters and numbers sat on the table. Algebra. Each day that passed, a sliver of regret crept in. I shouldn't have come back to this age. I double-checked to ensure that some were incorrect. I had no desire to place hope in my teachers that I would go far. I just needed to pass, the less eyes on me. The doorbell rang. The tune filled the air in the small apartment. I raised my head to see if anyone else would tend to it, but Father had passed out against the kitchen cupboard, a half-empty bottle tucked close to his chest, and Mother's eyes were glued to the television, unmoving. I rose from the table, a creak in the chair as the legs caressed the floorboard. Avoiding the glass fragments from yesterday's argument, I moved to the door. My fingers brushed aside the thin curtain that lined the near window. A man with a monocle stood tapping a silver-knobbed cane in a short rhythm. A bowler hat fitted his head, paired with an overcoat that hung to his ankles covering his trousers. He stood out like a sore thumb in today's era of skinny jeans and graphic tees. I breathed in, my hands shaking as I let the curtain fall back into place. I unlocked the door, opening it just wide enough that my body could block the view from my mother. A thin, see-through gate still separated us. I glanced up at him. "How can I help you?" The man's lips pulled tight. "Good day. I am looking for Attica Marley." My heartbeat picked up at the mention of my real name. I scanned the man. I didn't sense anything from him. I clicked the latch of the second gate and pushed it open. This grabbed Mother's attention. Her voice rose over the show's chatter. "Riley, who's at the door?" The man's left brow rose. I turned a bit towards her, my eyes not leaving his. "Just another seller." "Oh," she grunted, "tell him to get the hell off my porch." "Will do. You're Attica Marley?" "Yes," I said, "but I go by Riley here." "Apologies," he said. His hand reached into his pocket, pulling out a silver device. My lips twitched. A temporal scanner. He held it up to my forehead. A soft light shined over my face. A faint beep met my ears, which confirmed to him that even though I resembled a prepubescent teen, I was telling the truth. The man's shoulder relaxed. "Pardon me. I sometimes forget your true capabilities." He tucked the scanner away and held out his hand. "It's nice to meet you, Timekeeper." I shook his hand. "My name is Melodius. I am a messenger on behalf of Mr. Darth." A smile formed at the mention of the director. "How is he?" Melodius's smile fell, a hard look taking its place, speaking 1,000 unsaid words. I swallowed, ignoring the way my stomach sank. I had lost contact with Mr. Darth when the uprising happened. We had fled our separate ways from the Time Guild. "He fought to the very end," Melodius said, pulling out a crisp blue envelope. "I mustn't stay long, but I was tasked to deliver this to you." I grasped it. "When are you from?" 1892, France," he said. "I helped build the Eiffel Tower." I cracked a smile. "Sounds fun." "You've taken a modern approach." He glances at the suburban neighborhood. "A family, too?" "I didn't want to work," I said. "Thank you for this." Melodius tipped his hat to me and disappeared into a portal. I turned back inside. My life as a high schooler had come to an end. My thumb fitted under the fold and tore the envelope open. Cursive writing in dark ink stared back at me, as though the man in his final moments thought to write the best. Dear Attica, I pray to God that you are well. If you are, however, reading this, then I am no longer alive. The Timekeepers Guild has reconvened, now under the leadership of the Rebellion. They disgrace the sacred timeline, and it will be only a matter of time before they find you. That was a pun. I hope you enjoyed it. It is your duty now to protect its sacredness. You will always be dear to my heart, even if it no longer thumps with life. Sincerely, D.F. My fingers trembled as I held the letter to my chest. The thought of the rebellion caused goosebumps to cover my arms. What had seemed like another tasking time at the Guild had turned into a disarray of chaos and disruption. They had intervened with what's sacred for selfish reasons. Those who stood with Director Darth fled into hiding, and if they'd found him, they definitely knew where I was. What's that? I side-eyed the woman, Beth, whom I'd called Mother for a few fixed years. It's nothing. She shook her head. Bring it over. Let me see. I sighed and raised my hand. The letter evaporated into thin air. Beth's brown eyes widened. Her mouth dropped open. I walked to her, watching as she leaned back, trying to put distance between us. Thank you, I spoke, for lending me your time. Her brows drew together, a scowl slowly forming on her lips. I also apologize for intruding in on your life. I waved my hand over her forehead before she could say a word. Memories of her and I flitted through my mind, ones I had imputed, now being erased, replaced with the way in which she would have lived her life without me. Beth's head fell back. She would be out for a few hours. I did the same to Frank, who was still out cold, drool now spilling from his lips. I ran up the stairs. The weight of my body grew heavier with each step as I released the tension. My limbs stretched to their normal size, hips filled out, and curly hair now brushed my back. It felt nice to be back in my own body. I faced my bedroom. Scattered clothing strewn about and posters disappeared with a flick of my hand, now back to a storage room, boxes, knick-knacks, and college mementos. I felt the shift in energy before I could glance at the door. Crap. A knock, then another and another, slow, deliberate, and taunting. They were here. I waved my hand in the air, opening a portal. I had to be wise. Jumping too far back required energy that I needed to conserve, so I chose forward 20 years. 2020. My feet hit the pavement. I was in another neighborhood. The sun was low and the surroundings lively, with families moving to and fro. I turned on my heel. You know, a familiar voice began behind me, I've been dreaming of this day. Mist soldiers began to materialize around me, all with scepters pointed towards me. Their eyes glowed blue, telling me they were imbued with her temporal energy. I paused, turning slowly to be met with monolid eyes fitted in a glare towards me. Her hair was shorter now, curtaining her cheeks in a bob, the Time Guild's crests on the chest of her black-fitted uniform. Heyun smiled. Hello, Attica. Or is it Riley? She tilted her head at me. You lack creativity. My lips pulled tight as I raised my palm, energy drawing to my fingertips. Come on, Heyun folded her arms. It doesn't have to go this way. My jaw clenched. I'm not going with you. Her soldiers raised their spears. She lifted a palm, halting their actions. I get it. I do. She huffed out of breath, kicking a rock away. Unfortunately, the director doesn't. He wants to speak with you, she said, folding her hands. No matter how much you may deserve it, I'm under strict orders to not harm you. I raised a brow. That's new. But those around us, that's fine with you, right? Hayon flicked her finger in the direction of a young mother patting her infant. A soldier spun towards her, shooting a blast of blue light out of the scepter. The baby evaporated into dust. I tilted my head. My palm extended and I reversed the effect. Not a second later, the mother's crescent eyes remained the same, not even realizing that her bundle of joy had ceased to exist. So you do have a heart. Hayoun's tilted upward. She waved her arms around to the people that walked by, unaware that we were here. I remember Darth saying we shouldn't fret, that some things are meant to die, that it's just a few seconds of excruciating pain and then nothingness. Her fists clenched at her sides before relaxing. You followed him, didn't you? So we should continue. I swallowed a deep sigh, leaving my lips. Stop it. Her lips tilted upward as she shook her head at me. No, you stand behind laws that you can't even face. What's the difference? She jerked her head. Surrender, then it ends. Shots rang out around us as shades of blue light whizzed past me. Her soldiers, now materialized, began marching through the area. Screams echoed in the neighborhood as people ran in different directions. Children who played in the park and those being offloaded by the school bus to awaiting parents were vaporized one by one, leaving the next screaming in their stead until they were silenced themselves. I looked at Hayoun, a sweat on her brow and a grimace on her lips, but she wasn't going to budge. I let out a breath. I surrender. Silence. The soldiers ceased their onslaught, leaving just a few people tripping over themselves to get away. Perfect, she said and waved a hand at me. Now go on. I glared at her before crouching down and placing my fingertips on the warm asphalt. A wave of temporal energy shot out from me. A yellow light, mist, covered the area around us. Shadows of the moments before reversed until the sounds of laughter filled the air again. Wow, Hayon huffed at me. The talents of a variant. Shame that such power is wasted on a small mind. A soldier stepped to me and placed a restraint on my wrist. She turned and sliced open space and stepped through. Let's go. The tip of the scepter pushed into my back and I walked. On the other side, we were met with a white bridge, the Time Guild. Over the edge, I could see the ongoing business of timekeepers bustling about. Traitors. A tall golden door stood at the edge of the bridge, opening on its lonesome as we neared, giving a view of a large room, the director's, a golden desk and chair situated in the center. Clocks hung on the wall with different time zones. A large circular watch face was embedded in the floor. The hand continued on as we walked over it. Constant ticking that could drive someone up a wall filled the space. A scent of old pages, ancient with a mix of history, that says the room told stories. The chair behind the desk spun around, revealing a middle-aged man with long, wavy black hair. He had a grin that I wanted to wipe off. Welcome to the new and improved Time Guild, his voice timbered through the room as he stood. Headed by me, Elric Thorne. He gestured to himself. I blinked at him. He cleared his throat and rounded the table. Well, it's not like I was expecting a warm welcome. He glanced at Hayoun and the soldiers. You may leave, thank you. Are you sure? Hayoun eyed me wearily. I shook the cuffs around my wrist and tilted my head at her. She rolled her eyes and left, the soldiers on her tail. We were now alone. I apologized for Sergeant Kim's way of bringing you here. He frowned a bit. She has a peculiar way of getting things done. You must be wondering why I brought you here. To be frank, we have no need for miscreants from the old regime. He sighed. This is strictly personal. I need a favor from you. I raised a brow. Favor? She speaks, he grinned, waving his hand. Yes, a favor. But first, what did you think of the place? I redecorated. My hands pulled against the cuffs. Do you think this is a joke? Sorry, he said. I'm not one for hostile air. It became hostile when Heyun vaporized innocent people to force me here. Yes, well, I did already apologize for that, he shrugged. But those people are still alive because of you. His eyes turned into slits, which is very different to what you would have done in the past. I glanced away. That's different. How so? We've always had the power to stop disasters, mass murder, millions of tragic deaths, and yet you stood by and let those things happen, he said. You said it was fate. I grew to despise keepers like you. However, he eyed me, I believe that in everyone there is some good. I just have to see if you have certainly abandoned your old ways. He leaned back against the desk. Now, what is it that I want from you? I blinked. I was hoping you'd get to that. You're one of a few variants with enough temporal dexterity to master space and time. Elric walked towards me. You want me to go back in time for you? I sighed. Heyun can do that. She is able to carry me, yes. He rolled his head from left to right. But I need something in the past changed. I nodded hesitantly. And if I do this, you leave me alone? He smirked. Certainly. Think of the place and time, I said, grasping his hand. It's never left my mind, he answered quietly. A second later, we were in the middle of a street, sometime in the late 70s, in the city of London. Chatter and the honks of cars sounded through the air until a loud bang ricocheted. A car ran the light and swerved into a pole. Passers-by rushed in the vehicle's direction. I followed Elric's lead towards the scene. I paused the time, freezing everyone in their tracks, and turned to him to question why we were here. But his eyes never left the sight. I glanced back. What I had missed was a young girl, maybe 8, laid out on the ground with blood seeping from the crown of her head and lips. Her chest was still. Elric stood frozen, eyes wide and shaky, taking in the girl. I swallowed. It's her. My voice held no uncertainty. Elric flinched. I asked Darth, when I first joined, if he could bring her back. He swallowed visibly, but slowly neared her, still figure, kneeling at her side. I even promised to dedicate my life to being a keeper, to whatever cause. Yet he refused, said, what's dead is dead. He glanced at me. If you can, please. He scooped the little girl up and held her close to his chest. To bend the time continuum, I began, you would need to put something in the place of the other. To prevent one disaster, another takes its place. You revive someone. Someone else must die. Only if you lack the temporal energy to absorb it, he said. I tilted my head. That was the part that Darth kept hidden. He knew that if we joined together, we could absorb it. He shook his head. He knew that we could prevent disasters. Yet he commanded that we never interfere. Elric glanced at me. The world may not deserve her, but she should get the chance to experience it, he nodded. If it means my Belle lives, then you do it. but I don't have enough to absorb this. He smiled softly. I know. My hand shook. And your master plan to take over the world? You're just giving it up? He chuckled at me, shaking his head. And here I thought you wouldn't hesitate. He breathed out, pushing a strand out of Bell's face. My master plan was only to make the guild take notice of the truth, what our purpose is, to save, even if it's just one. I stared at him. You put too much trust in me, I said. Elric didn't budge. What if I start a war when you're gone? You wouldn't, he glanced at me. The fact that you're still here says enough. Now drop the cuffs and do it. I can't bear the sight any longer. I flicked my hands and the cuffs disintegrated, worthless against my enemy. The same yellow mist fitted around my fingertips and I angled it to the little girl's forehead. I looked at Elric again and he nodded, a finality in his eyes. My energy surged forth. His hair started to turn gray as the girl's chest began to rise and fall, a pattern that said she was returning. His wrinkled hand reached up to cup her cheek, thumb rubbing sweetly as though he was remembering the touch for the afterlife. A single tear slipped down his cheek until his hand fell slowly. I turned my head. The onlookers, still frozen in time, stared back at me. I extended my hand, wiping their memories. One day it may return as deja vu. A groan filled the air, causing me to glance back. Belle's hands were balled up and fists rubbing her eyes. She blinked rapidly, taking in the scene around her. Belle scrunched her nose and looked down at the director's lifeless body. I'd have to wipe this from her memory. Who's the old man? She said. The Paperweight Library by Stevie Burgess. Mavis was now in her second year of retirement. Most days she found things to do, but to be honest, she felt bored. Money was tight. It always had been. For decades, she'd worked for a large cleaning company that serviced offices, shopping malls, and municipal buildings. The staff room was always full of women, but they weren't exceptionally social. They exchanged greetings, asked after each other's families, then hurried home to husbands and children who needed feeding and fussing. After Clive's early death, Mavis simply got on with it, took the extra shifts, did her job well, came home to a quiet house, made a small supper, watched the telly, and turned in early so she could rise again at 4:30 the next morning. When her 65th birthday came around, the company announced a farewell do. Mavis didn't have the confidence to tell them she didn't want one, nor that she would have gladly worked another 10 years if they'd let her. So she accepted the card, the chocolates, and the traditional clock, smiled politely, and went home battling back tears of loneliness and loss, not because of sentiment, but because of the strange emptiness of it all. Now, with no job to go to, no family to call, and no close friends to meet, she often felt she was simply existing, and never much of a reader. And these days, the idea of picking up a book just made her feel even more alone. Sitting in her spotless front room, hands resting in her lap, she sighed and looked around. Everything gleamed. Everything was in its place. Still, something wasn't right. Her eye fell on the neatly folded local newspaper. She reached for it out of habit, flicked past the headlines, skipped the letters page, and turned, as she always did, to situations vacant. She tutted at herself. Don't be daft. You're 66. Who's going to hire you now? But then something caught her eye. Birkingsdale University, situations vacant. Part-time cleaner needed for old library building. Contents must be prepared for auction. Books and fixtures require thorough cleaning. Ideal for an experienced individual who can work independently with minimal supervision. Interviews will be held at the Academic Registry, Main Assembly Hall at 10 a.m. on Tuesday, 10th June. References and letters of recommendation are essential. She sat bolt upright in her chair. It doesn't mention age, she thought excitedly. It says experienced. You have to be old if you're experienced. She'd never been one for friendships. Even Clive, her late husband, hadn't been much company. She took a deep breath and wondered if there were anyone she could contact to ask whether they thought she should be suitable. But as she flicked through her semi-dormant brain cells, she couldn't come up with anyone. Go on Tuesday for the interview. They can only say no. As the days passed, she began to feel more and more excited about the prospect of securing the part-time cleaning job. A reason to rise in the morning, a reason to prepare an evening meal for herself, a reason to sort through clean clothes for the early hours of the morning and set off for a responsible day of work, returning home to know that within a few hours she would be required to start the day all over again. How wonderful this would be. She arrived 10 minutes early at the appointed place. She noticed a row of chairs arranged against the wall, and after standing for a few minutes in anticipation of others' arrivals, eventually shrugged her shoulders and selected a seat in the middle of the row, perching her brown faux leather handbag on her knee as she waited. At precisely 10 o'clock, the door to the north of the main assembly hall swung open, and a gentleman with curly gray hair, likely in his late 70s, entered, dressed in a brown corduroy jacket with leather patches on each elbow. He glanced at Mavis and approached her. Mavis shifted her handbag and rose to her feet, bowing her head as he stood before her. "Hello, are you the 10 o'clock appointment for the cleaner, the library, don't you know?" "Yes, sir, I am," said a nervous Mavis. "Oh, please sit down. I am Jack Brown, the ex-librarian. And who might you be?" "I'm Mrs. Stevens, Mavis Stevens." "Ah, Mavis Stevens, good to meet you. Would you mind sharing a bit about yourself, your previous jobs and your experience in cleaning, preparing, and classifying items for auction?" "Oh, nothing like that, sir. I'm just a good cleaner. I've worked all my life cleaning and tidying. Most of the offices here in town, private houses and large shopping malls, that sort of thing. I have never worked in a university before and have never prepared items for an auction, but I can learn if you show me." Jack Brown smiled. "Yes, I can show you what is required. After you've been shown what to do, do you think you can work on your own, Mrs. Stevens? We did not intend to employ more than one person, and as you can see, you appear to be the only candidate for the job." Mavis smiled excitedly. "Oh, yes, Mr. Brown, I enjoy working on my own, no problem at all." "Well done, Mrs. Stevens. Shall I walk you to the library where you'll be working? I'll explain what is needed, and if you are still interested, we'll discuss your terms of employment. Is that all right?" Mavis found her first few weeks enjoyable, yet tiring. She was working in what had once been the university's central library. Over the years, various specialized libraries had been established, and as Dr. Brown informed her, the main library had ultimately outgrown its usefulness. Dr. Brown continued his work in the library, but as his retirement approached, a decision was made to close the old library. All fixtures and fittings would be auctioned off, and ultimately the library would be demolished, with new university buildings constructed and allocated to various disciplines. Days turned into weeks and weeks into months. Mavis let herself into the old library each working day, and apart from Dr. Brown, saw no one at all. She never questioned where anyone was. After all, this building was being prepared for demolition. Everyone else must be working somewhere. Against one of the walls, large plastic cartons had been arranged, and Mavis had been instructed to pack the books she had meticulously dusted and polished as soon as Dr. Brown had catalogued each one. The two got along splendidly. He rarely spoke, and Mavis worked as she always had, in complete silence. One day, while working alone as usual, Mavis passed the large library table in the center of the room and noticed a peculiar heavy glass paperweight she didn't recall having seen before. It rested on a jade-green base which bore a tarnished brass nameplate. Although it was in dire need of a polish, she could just make out the words, Birkingsdale Library, 1952. That puzzled her. It was 1952. Yet the paperwork seemed old, as if it were belonged to another era. Strange, she thought. The dome, however, gleamed as if she had just polished it to a shine. It was a handsome piece. She returned to her tasks. But a faint dusting on the table caught her eye. Clutching her ever-reliable yellow duster, she leaned in, inhaling the familiar scent of polished teak, and began to wipe the surface. In the hush of the old library, a flicker of movement startled her. She straightened sharply. Had she just seen a mouse? She turned in a swift half-circle, scanning for any sign of rodent life. Nothing. Stillness. The silence returned. Her gaze wandered back to the paperweight. For the first time, she realized the dome housed a miniature scene, a diorama of the very room in which she stood, captured in exquisite detail. Books, desks, shelves, and arches, all perfectly scaled. But as she looked, disbelief washed over her. Inside the paperweight, tiny figures were moving, browsing, turning pages, and consulting one another. The library, contained within the dome, was alive. Mavis leaned closer. There were students, professors, and people chuckling quietly or engrossed in their studies. The same towering bookcases, now brimming with books, had spines that gleamed. The worn library she had been dusting for weeks was transformed. In the far corner of the teak desk, she heard a tiny female student sigh loudly. She gasped. Another minute figure appeared, distinctly audible as it spoke. Are you struggling with that research paper? Shall I fetch you a cup of tea? Mavis blinked in disbelief. Had she really heard that? Surely not. She cast a glance around her own library. No Dr. Brown. No one, just her and this impossible dome. Mavis continued to gaze in wonder, transfixed by the unfolding scene inside the paperweight. She leaned in further. The double wooden doors at the miniature library swung open and closed as more figures arrived, some young, some older. There was a bustle of quiet industry. At the back of the scene, near a large table, stood a catering area with a tea urn, pots, cups, and biscuits. A woman in crisp white linen smiled kindly at each visitor. Mavis leaned in so closely that her cheek nearly touched the glass. The scene seemed to swell, becoming more detailed. Then the catering lady looked up and waved. Mavis recoiled, her heart racing. The woman was her. Not quite as she looked now, but as she had been. Open-faced, content, radiant. It was like seeing a happier ghost of herself. Before she could make sense of it, a voice behind her said, "Ah, you found us, Mrs. Stevens." It was Dr. Brown, who had appeared quietly alongside her. "I don't understand, Dr. Brown. What is this?" He looked gently towards the dome. "Well, that's you. The woman waving? You know her quite well, don't you?" She glanced again, then turned back to him. "But I thought I was cleaning, helping with an auction. I never saw this before." Dr. Brown gave a soft chuckle. "May I call you Mavis? I'm Jack." She nodded warily. "During your interview time here, you have proven yourself. We needed someone who could move quietly among us, someone gentle, someone who could bring comfort." "My interview?" She said, her eyes widening. "I've been here for weeks. Did you think I wasn't doing a good job?" Jack shook his head. "You've been doing exactly what we hoped for. It wasn't your cleaning we were assessing. It was your presence." Mavis turned away from him and looked back into the dome. The catering woman herself was now joined by a gray-haired man who was being offered a steaming hot cup of tea. "Oh, look," Jack said with a laugh. "Seems to be me." Mavis blinked. She anticipated seeing the vast, dusty library behind her, but instead, when she turned, she found herself inside the dome. "But what is this place?" she whispered. Jack smiled. "We'd like to offer you a permanent position inside the paperweight." She stared, dumbfounded. "We've all passed on, you see," he explained. "Librarians, readers, quiet souls. The sort the world forgets, but the paperweight remembers. It holds what mattered to us, and when you died, just weeks after retirement, our chief librarian asked whether we'd like you to join us." "Me? Died?" she said faintly. She looked down at herself in her white linen uniform, content, composed. "I don't feel dead," she murmured. "In fact, I look more alive than I have in years." "We thought you might prefer catering over shelving," said Jack. "You're not a big reader after all, but your presence brings comfort and tea, and that's something we value very highly." The edges of the dome began to shimmer and then vanished. She hadn't moved, yet she was inside, entirely at last. Gentle hands guided her to the large chairs in the corner. Around her, voices rose in welcome. She sipped the tea they had brought her and looked around, proud of the shelves she had polished to such a shine. "Jack," she asked. "Yes, Mavis?" "What happens to the paperweight when they knock the building down?" Jack smiled. "Oh, Mavis, the old library was demolished years ago. The chief librarian is the custodian now. The paperweight is passed down from the chief librarian to the next chief librarian. It's in excellent hands." And Mavis, who'd known so little joy in life with Clive, found it at least inside the glass, with gentle purpose, quiet friendship, and a seat by the kettle. The Game by Hannah Cumber. Freezing bark scraped against my face as I balanced two-thirds of the way up an oak tree. Winter had made the branches brittle and the rough wood cut into my bare feet. A gust lifted the branch beneath me. I dug my fingers into the trunk and pressed closer. I could hear the scratch tap of the beetles inside the bark. An old tree. Energy swelled deep within the trunk of the oak. Most of the younger trees had pulled their magic, retreating and binding it deep underneath the steeping earth. But the oak was holding on, fighting the bite of cold with its size and deeper magic. Winter howled and came again through the branches. I saw the wave of trees bend to its will and shifted my weight before the gust hit. The wind clawed at the thin cloth of my tunic, trying to pull me from the tree. It knew I didn't belong there. I gritted my teeth. Whoever said steady as an oak never had to find their food on top of one? I glanced up, four branches up and two over. That's where I'd seen the squirrel go. The wind dropped into a keening whine between the gusts. My stomach let out an answering roar. It had been 2 days since I'd eaten. I could already feel my body growing sluggish, and not only from the cold. Time to move. I let go of the trunk and pulled myself up to the next one, my eyes tracking the best path through the branches. I crouched, battling the sway of the tree and trying to time my movements between the angry lashes of the wind. There, up onto the next one. I was getting close. The branches were getting thinner the higher I went, but most were clustered close together this high up, making for an easy climb, or it would be without the wind. I reached for the next branch, an awkward angle. I leaned around a bulge in the trunk for a better hold. Almost there. A sharp gust tore the branch from under me, my fingers locked, one hand clawing at the bark of the trunk, the other barely holding onto the branch above me. For a second, I hung suspended. The wind smashed into the sail of my clothing and slammed my body into the trunk. Twigs clawed at my arms and hands and face. I heaved in a breath and scrabbled for purchase with my feet. Ivy and bark rained down into my face. I kicked, and my feet found a knot in the trunk. It was enough. Keeping my eyes slitted against the debris, I kicked against the knot and managed to heave myself up and over the next branch, pressing as close to the trunk as I could. I felt the bark split the skin on my shin as I hauled myself into a messy crouch, one arm hooked around the trunk. 3 steps and it was over. My hand found the opening in the tree. Magic cracked across my hand and seared through the scar on my right palm. I gathered it, forming the forks of magic into a shape, an intention in my mind. My fingers brushed fur. Break. I felt the tiny bone snap in the squirrel's neck. A quick kill. I was getting better. The branch beneath me cracked. Of course, there was always room for improvement. My hand closed on the squirrel. I fell. Twigs and branches whipped at me, slicing across my freezing arms and face. Winter howled its victory. I smashed into a large branch. What little breath I had exploded from my chapped lips. I landed badly. My right arm smashed into the frozen ground with a sickening crunch. I felt through my chest and back. I was lucky there wasn't breath enough left to scream. There were hungrier things in the forest than me. A biting, seeping cold crept from my elbow up to my shoulder and neck. I moved slowly, testing my arm, pushing myself up until I was half sat, half slumped. Every fraction of movement drew a whimper of pain, no matter how hard I tried to keep my mouth closed. I glanced down, broken, again. Nausea washed against the back of my throat. The trees sharpened their dull winter gray, taking on a sickly green, too bright to starting to stretch. I closed my eyes and breathed hard through my nose, too far to safety and too open where I was. Every move sent a jolt of broken glass skittering down my arm. My heart was beating too fast. Not good. I heard my mother's voice scratching underneath the wind. You're lucky that young bones heal quickly. I let my head fall back against the oak. Breaking things was easy. Mending them was the hard part. The cold from the ground seeped into my legs, my stomach, rough bark pressed into my spine. I held still and let my heart beat slow. The throb in my arm slowed, matching my pulse. Slow, slower. I reached for the cold seeping from the wet ground, the rough bite of the tree, and willed it to be more. I pulled the magic to me. The ground beneath me grew instantly, uncomfortably hot. The tree resisted. It was always harder to take from living things. The closer they were to life, the harder it was to draw from. I concentrated and pulled harder. A barrier broke, like dawn frost under a boot, and then I could see. Roots tangled in the hot black soil. The last of the stubborn leaves brushed against each other in the gale. The tree reached its search for light, and its strength seeped into the sky, changing it, filtering the air, branches scraping the clouds. There was a moment of vertigo where I could feel myself against the tree, a small form, part of it all, and yet a part. I pulled away and focused higher up the tree. There I felt my lips quirk in a grimace. I would take a branch. Magic-like balance, after all. I condensed the flow of my will and wrapped it along the length of the branch. The scar on my left palm prickled, grew hot. Pressure grew in my arm and my fingers curled. I placed the scar gingerly against the swelling of my right arm, right at the elbow. Bind. I released the magic. As a branch high above me snapped, the bones in my right arm crashed back together. Now I screamed. I hissed air through my teeth. It was a while before I could open my eyes. The soil around me was black ash. Any water had been driven from the area, and blades of grass lay desiccated and shriveled along the outline of my legs. Two branches and the squirrel lay next to me. One branch was barely more than charcoal, splintered and broken beyond repair. The other was covered in new growth. Shoots and new leaves sprouted amongst a thick layer of lichen. There had been a small colony of mushrooms by the base of the branch, and these had sprouted and now thrived, spreading out along the entire length, a balance to my breaking. I didn't look at the other branch. Carefully, I flexed my right arm. Much better. Carefully, I got to my feet, picked up the squirrel, and grinned. Worth it. Mother had said not to catch the squirrels. It wasn't worth the danger. My smile slipped as I felt the echoes of pain dance across the outline of the scars on my palms. Mother had been wrong about a lot of things. The hair on the back of my neck stood up. A low growl brushed the air behind me, the kind you feel in your chest. It had found me. I flattened against the trunk of the tree, tucking the squirrel quickly into my belt. I was pretty sure it couldn't smell me, or it would have caught me by now. I bit my lip. It had been the scream. Another growl, closer. I glanced upward to the branches of the oak. It would take too long. The creature was taller than me and knew it could climb faster. Its arms were unnaturally long. The last thing I needed was to trap myself at the top of a tree. I pressed my back to the bark, willing the shadows to swallow me. My only chance was to run. I knew this part of the forest and would be faster than it through the brush. The ancient trees stood too closely together, and the tangle of undergrowth would slow it down. My mind traced every deer path and foxhole from me to the hide. As long as I avoided the open ground of the meadow, I could make it. The scrape of claws over wood, a huff of a breath. It was behind the tree. I ran. The creature howled. The sound ripped through the trees, flushing birds and rodents from their homes. The skin across my back prickled. I could almost feel its claws on my spine. It was close. I flew between the trees, feet high to avoid the tangled ground. Faster. The beast's clawed feet ripped at the ground behind me. It was getting closer. I could smell it. An overpowering musk of raw animal, and something underneath, something sour that licked at the back of my brain. Decay. There, an opening in the undergrowth. Not much, just enough to squeeze through. I felt the pounding rhythm behind me change pace and knew it was going to pounce. At the last moment, I threw myself sideways and into the hollow. Branches scraped my arms and face as I wiggled through. There was a crash and a resounding roar. The thicket shook. I yelped and covered my ears, wriggling deeper into the briar. The creature roared and swiped at the brush with one huge claw. Debris rained down and getting into my eyes and my mouth. I coughed, choking, and kept going, pushing through until I was out at the other side. I scrambled to my feet and ran for the cave. I called it the cave, but it was more like a crack. Two huge pillars of stone from some ancient hall had crumbled against a short cliff face, leaving an enclosed hollow that was the closest thing to a home I knew. The entrance was hidden in a cascade of ivy, appearing more like a fissure in the rock than anything welcoming. But it opened into a mostly dry space with room for a fire and cracks for the smoke. Home. I took the squirrel and a knife from my belt and crouched beside the blackened circle of stones. My fingers touched the twigs left ready in the pit. Burn. A large part of my lower back pulsed and grew warm as the wood caught fire, magic tracing the rune in my scarred skin. Sometimes I forgot where some of the scars were, but not this one. This one I hated more than any of the others. This one I would carve from my body if I could reach it. This one had kept me alive when I should have died, and I had paid for it. A small shoot pushed its way out of the soil beside my foot, a tiny vine with purple flowers. I smiled. I fed more wood to the fire until it was blazing and sat back on my heels, letting the heat from the flames chase the aches from my muscle. That had been close. The monster was getting faster. A half-heard noise locked my body in place. The scuff of claws over stone. The hair on the back of my neck rose. I turned. The monster stood in the mouth of the cave. Grotesque patches of fur over its belly and chest caught the light of the small fire. It stood a full head taller than me, four powerful overlong limbs pressing into the ground, each lined with 6-inch-long claws. Its body tensed, muscles bunching over a prominent spine. It watched me, shadows pooling in its eyes. Drool slid down one set of its enormous teeth as its lips peeled back for a growl. I sighed. You know the rules. The growl escaped, filling the cave and forcing its way into my chest, stealing my breath. Last one home has to share. I held out my hand. The monster bared its teeth and snapped at me, fangs dangerously close to my fingers. I regarded it. The monster threw its head back and howled. Despair and heartbreak smothered the flames. The fire flickered, close to going out. I waited. The monster lowered its head. Its eyes flashed in the muted light, a hollow dark red. It shifted and dragged its hind leg forward, a small hair caught in its claws. I retrieved the food and placed it beside the squirrel on a flat rock at the back of the cave. It only took me a moment to strip the skin and prepare the meat. Bones went into a small pot for stew, but I was too hungry to wait for that now. I considered the skins. I needed new gloves. The winter was sharper this year, and I would probably regret not having wraps for my feet, but the rules of the cave were simple. Share or die. I threw the skins to the monster. He snapped them out of the air, swallowing without chewing. I didn't know if it was actually a he, but at some point I had just started thinking of him that way. He was still sulking, lurking in the corner by the entrance. I skewered the meat on tiny twigs and secured them over the flames, coaxing the fire back to a healthy burn. I approached the monster. He turned his head away from me, almost pressing his forehead into the wall. I bit down on a laugh. "Don't sulk." He ignored me. I lifted my hand and reached up, carefully placed it on the back of his neck, away from the teeth. The monster leaned in and I grinned. The game was an old one. One I had played for years. Survive. The monster had lived in the forest before I did, before I was ever born. It would have eaten me. Those were the rules. The strong ate the weak. And when my mother died, it should have taken what nature demanded, but it didn't. Instead, we played the game. I moved my hand through his fur. My palms still hurt from using the runes. It always hurt, like I was carving them all over again. The monster huffed and leaned into me. I scratched behind his ears. He had magic, too. Deep, woven of ancient things, but not unnatural like Mother claimed. Just a balance. He was as necessary to life in the forest as the life-giving water running through the streams. Soaking the earth, running up the roots, trunks, sleeves, and out into the sky, his magic was old, darker, of the soil and decomposing things, but still a part of it all. So I accepted him without judgment, and he, me. There was still fear. I wasn't stupid. And fear had kept me alive more times than I cared to count. But there was also respect. Something reflected in the depths of our magic. Something shared that kept us both alive. Two monsters in the forest.